No, he won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No.
Good morning and welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. We have a great show coming up for you today. In the first hour, we'll have Scott Mihalik, who is going to be running in the 38th Assembly District against Clayfish. He'll be on in a moment. We also have Yuri Raskin of the Fenn Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup to talk about the weekly news. I'll have Representative Andy Jorgensen. He'll be on to discuss the secret arrangements and budget raids that Walker says doesn't really occur. And we'll end the hour with Secretary of State Doug LaFollette. He'll be on to discuss his candidacy for governor. In the second hour, that was only the first hour, so in the second hour, I will start the hour with Paul DeMaine, the publisher from News from Indian Times. He's going to discuss the giveaway to the mining company's mining bill. Then I will talk with Nicole Safar from Planned Parenthood on the attack on women's health in Wisconsin and across the country. And we will finish off the hour with Representative Chris Taylor, and she will be discussing the war on women in the legislature in Wisconsin, and of course we'll probably bring in some of the stuff going on in the country as well. The phone number to call if you have any questions is 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. We also have a live discussion online at blogtalkradio.com, and you can post your questions or comments there as well. Now, before we go on, I want to talk about an announcement.
My name is Lori Compass. I live in Fort Atkinson, and today I'm announcing my candidacy for the state Senate seat. But I decided to run, and this is why. Because this campaign is not about me. It's about all of us.
Good morning, Bill. We have an announcement about Lori Compass's, you know, I will say that name right eventually. Lori Compass's campaign.
Yes, Sarah, for you and all of our listeners, Lori Compass's campaign kickoff event will be held on Saturday, March 17th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m., which will be held at the Fireman's Park Pavilion, 1049 Park Avenue in Columbus, Wisconsin. So save the date. More info to come. There will be additional events and speakers to be added. So to follow Lori and her campaign, go to www.loricompass.org. Again, www.loricompass.org.
Great. Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. That was Bill, the producer.
You're welcome.
And we will be following Lori's campaign because I think it's important. As we follow all the campaigns, actually, it's not just Lori's, but it's everyone's campaign. So if you're running for office or you know someone running for office and they'd like to get on and talk about what they're running and what their stances are, please let me know, and I'm more than happy to get everyone on. I think it's important that we know who is running. I think it's important we know their platforms, and I think it's important that we also go out and vote. Being a voter is our right. There's a lot of countries where they fight for that right, and we have it given to us. So please use your voice, go out and be a voter. Speaking of voter, first I'd like to introduce Yuri. Good morning, Yuri. How are you?
I'm doing great. Good morning, Sarah.
Good. And before we get to Yuri in the weekly news roundup, I have Scott Mihalik. He is running for the 38th Assembly District against Representative Clayfish. I'm not even sure what Clayfish's first name is. I just know him as Clayfish. So good morning, Scott.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So you're welcome. Thanks for being on this morning. Now, why are
and
you...
His first name is Joel.
Joel, yes. My producer just let me know that. He said it's Joel. I'm like, okay. I must have... All I know is his wife's name. I know him as Mr. Lieutenant Governor. So I'm not in his district either, so that's all right. Why are you running for assembly?
I think the biggest reason is time for... Jane and John Doe's average people, workers to have a voice in government once again. I think that big money interest and just big money candidates in general have taken our voice from us, and I think it's time for common ordinary people like myself to step up and run and represent in government.
What makes you different? Is there anyone else running against you, first of all? Or are you the only one that's declared right now?
I'm the only one who's declared. And I'll tell you, you know, if I had a chance to rename our party, if it were up to me, I'd rename our party the 20 to 70K party, because that's who I am. And that's the kind of people that I want to represent. You know, there's nothing wrong with having deep pockets, but when everybody that runs is a millionaire, especially in the National Congress, where I think it's somewhere around 80 to 85% of the National Congress are millionaires, I really kind of question whether they represent our best interests or just theirs.
Scott, how are you?
Good.
Good. I was curious, how are you planning on kind of drawing the distinction? Because there's several different ways, and I was kind of curious how you're planning to go about going after Bill Clayfish.
Well, I mean, if you really look at my district map now, I'm trying to represent the 38th Assembly District, which consists of my hometown of Marshall, Wisconsin, Deerfield, the Dane County portion of Cambridge, Johnson Creek and Lake Mills, as well as Oconomowoc. And if you look at the western half of my district, it's largely Democratic, and I think I resonate to that portion of my district. I'm a former union worker. I've worked in two manufacturing facilities that have been shut down for no other reason than corporate greed. And I think that, you know, the tax breaks that Walker has given to companies, even that lay off people, I think, we need a different approach. We need a different plan. And I think when I say my message to people as far as, you know, keeping jobs here in Wisconsin, keeping here jobs here in the United States, I think that message resonates to people of both sides of the aisle.
Great.
Scott, how would you bring jobs into your district?
Well, I want to work with local. I think what's been forgotten is the local governments, working with the local governments, using local TIFTA money that local governments have set aside for projects. Like in my hometown, for example, a couple of years ago in Marshall, they bought 26 acres of land. They didn't research it very well, 15 acres of its wetland that they can't build on by law. But there's 11 acres that has been sitting there for 10 or 12 years that they could be building an industrial park or something on. And I would like to work with the local governments to bring in businesses into our local communities.
What businesses are you looking
for? In my hometown as well, we have the Monashaw River. That is a silt eroding mess. If you try to put a boat prop in there or you try to send your kids swimming in there, well, they've only got about 1 foot depth and they're stepping into mud. I would like to look at our local lakes and river systems and try to do what we can to clean them up and make them into a recreational facility that I think could create jobs and tourism.
So basically you're going to look at what's there and try to augment what you already have.
Yes. I mean, every little local town has got different problems. Like where I live, my assemblyman is Keith Ripp, a Republican from Lodi. I have never seen this guy at a local village or town meeting. He only came to my hometown one time, and that was after the collective bargaining bill had been passed. And I think it was kind of to make amends for a bad bill that was passed, and it really wasn't effective. Other than that, you don't see our assemblyman until it's election time, you know. And I want to work with local people and local governments. I think that they deserve to be listened to, not just the corporate interests.
Yuri, I know you had a question. Go ahead if you wanted to ask it.
Well, I was just thinking about Joel Clayfish and his whole desire, I believe, to hunt cranes and to provide stronger protection for people in, what is this, prenuptial agreement? I mean, you know, I'm trying to think, you know, and of course he's now famous for voting for other people. So, you know, never mind his wife, he's got a pretty strong record of somebody that you want to get out of Madison. So I was just, you know, my congratulations to Scott for stepping up and running, and best of luck.
Thank you. You know, I think it's kind of a double standard when Joel Clayfish starts, you know, the governor had an emergency job session, and they turned it into a moralist session about women's health. And I think that Clayfish saying that a life form or the pill is wrong, and then turning around and saying, "Well, we need," I'm in favor of prenuptial agreements. To me, it's a big double standard, and I would like to engage Clayfish on the issues.
And if people want more information on your campaign and what you're going to be doing, where can they go to?
Okay, my website is www.mihalak, and I'm going to spell that last name. It's M-I-C-H-A-L-A-K, forassembly.com. And I would also like to mention that I am starting a sign-on .org petition on the Move On website starting March 20th. And what it curtails is I'm sending a petition nationwide to be signed to incentivize the Obama jobs bill to incentivize buying American goods. President Obama said in his jobs bill that he would offer a 100% write-off for companies that buy equipment for their companies. I would amend that and say make it 50% for equipment, make it 100% if it's an American-made product for equipment.
Okay. Well, and we'll look for that then as well. Will that be linked to your website?
It will be on moveon.org on their website. Also, you can address me on Facebook and at mihalakforassembly.com. And on my website, I've got that posted, and I'll have it posted again on March the 20th when it becomes public.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being on today. Good luck to you, and I hope to talk with you again. Maybe we can get you on for a little bit longer next time.
Okay. Thank you much.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Have a great day, and good luck.
Take care, Scott.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
That was Scott Mihalak, and again, if you want more information about him, you can go to his website at www.mihalakforassembly.com, M-I-C-H-A-L-A-K, forassembly.com, or Facebook, Mihalak for Assembly. Yuri.
Yep, I'm looking at Scott's Facebook page right now, and he's got this, instead of his picture, he's got this picture of a brown, you know, shoe, and it says, "I've been in your shoes." I love it. It's great. So, and Scott only has like 32 people that like his Facebook page. So, you know, get out there and click and like a Democratic candidate for Assembly. We need to get some information out there.
Yes, and that is also Senate District 13. Is that? Am I not mistaken on that?
Well, I think that we're going to leave it for maybe Bill to verify, because I don't want to give somebody wrong the Senate information.
I don't either, but I think that's also in that would be Fitzgerald's Senate district, or the one that Lori is.
Sounds about right, because there's a whole Johnson Creek, of course, with redistricting. I wouldn't bet on anything, but
yeah,
sounds about right. So I was thinking, you know, we have such an interesting set up here where we can really test what it means where you have grassroots support for your campaign versus, you know, and a strong dislike for the incumbent versus just a really strong dislike for the incumbent. We have two candidates. We have Lori Compass, who's running for state senate and currently has like 765 people liking her Facebook page. I'm sure not all of them are from her district. And then there is Kathleen Polk, who is running for governor. And I found draft Kathleen Polk for governor Facebook page. There's 67 people that like that. But you know there's a lot of people who don't like Scott Walker. So out of curiosity, I actually set up a little poll on my Facebook page saying if the Democratic nominee to run against Scott Walker is a can of old-style beer, I will vote for. So far, Scott Walker is waiting for his first vote. So I think there's a really, you know, it's just interesting for me to see how you have somebody who is a newcomer but really gets people excited versus somebody that doesn't generate that kind of excitement, but, you know, my goodness, would you vote for a can of beer or would you vote for Scott Walker? I'll vote for style, you know, can of old style. So as a political junkie, I'm just looking forward to seeing how this whole thing will play out and, of course, help whoever the Democratic nominee is. So it's going to be interesting.
And old style's not even that good of a beer, my understanding. I'm not real fond of beers in general, but
you know,
for people who drink
it, right?
I know, and I'm sorry. Actually, I'm celiac. I can't drink it, so there we go. That's my response.
Okay, well, you know, it's Wisconsin, so you better have a medical reason if you can't drink beer and you're old enough.
And I do, so we're good. I'm covered.
Perfect.
On that. But old style, my understanding is that it's not very good. So you go for a really bad-tasting beer over the governor.
Exactly. Let's see, a couple of things that people should – I don't know if you're going to have Chris Capper Libenthal back on your show today or not, but I just want to congratulate Chris because he was just been elected to the executive board of ASME Local 645 and re-elected as delegate to the Milwaukee Labor Council.
Excellent.
So
congratulations,
Chris.
Yes,
our friend Chris is staying busy. And, of course, Dave, yeah, go ahead.
I just have to make this. Someone posted it in the chat room, and I going back to the can of beer, someone, Ryan, posted, I would even vote for an empty can of beer over Walker.
Well, there you go. See, so even, you know, you don't even have to be a beer drinker. You'll vote for an empty can over Scott Walker.
Right.
So that's great. And today is March 2nd, which means happy birthday to Russ Feingold, who is 59 years old today. And, you know, if there ever was anybody who could just about have the governorship for the asking, you know, there's one man right there. But Russ announced that he is not going to be a candidate in 2012. So we'll move on to other news. And we have Chris actually wrote a very interesting story that people should check out on McIver Institute, which is, he says, anything but a news service. And in that, he really kind of takes it apart. And if you've been following the news of Wisconsin over the last year, periodically you're going to run into these YouTube videos by a friend of mine, Bill Osmolsky, who is a very conservative journalist. He used to work for the TV station that covered Rock County in Janesville, and that's how I know him. Because from, you know, being on the council, I interacted with Bill a few times. And he still lives in Janesville, but he works for McIver Institute. And, boy, I really like what Chris did, just taking apart each person and explaining what their resume is, what they have done. It's really good for people to understand what a right-wing organization McIver Institute is.
I believe it's a right-wing think tank. It's one of the ones that have been pushing out a lot of the information, a lot of stats as well. Isn't that stuff that Paul Ryan pulls out?
Sure. I don't know if there's a legal license to apply in order to call yourself a think tank. I suppose maybe me and my friends can get together at a coffee shop and call ourselves a think tank. I don't know if there's a license, appropriate licensing for that, so.
Not sure either, but you have about a minute left because I have Assembly Member Representative Andy Jorgensen has been so kindly waiting while we were discussing the empty can of beer. So you have about a minute left.
For everything else, well, I'll just say that check out Defend Wisconsin News Roundup, and because we keep posting new things, and if you want to stay on top of what's going on, there's about lots and lots of things that are happening. We have Scott Walker, who wants to challenge the recall signatures, but indirectly. We have Supreme Court that opts to close some meetings to the public, and really the whole public input is a huge issue in Wisconsin. It's getting bigger and bigger because we can't get records out of our government. We can't keep our government open. I think if you're concerned about government transparency at all, all of these things. That's kind of the common thread to all news stories that I've seen this week. Public is getting shut out of everything. So you got to pay attention, got to keep yourself educated, and listen to the Sarah Schultz Show.
Or read Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup.
Perfect.
So, Yuri, as always, thank you so much for being on, and thank you for being my guest interviewer with Scott, and I will talk with you next week.
Sounds great. Say hi to Andy.
I definitely will. I'll talk to you later, Yuri.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Yuri Raskin with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. You can follow him on Facebook. He is really good at posting stories. He does a daily one, and then at the end of the week, he'll ask you what your favorite story is. So definitely worth following him. Now I'm going to go straight to Representative Andy Jorgensen, who is the representative of the 37th Assembly District. Thank you so much for holding on. I really appreciate you waiting. And welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, Andy.
Glad to be here. Hi, Sarah.
I hope you were enjoying our little comments about the can of beer and the empty beer and
yeah, it's a wild time right now, that's for sure.
It definitely is. If anyone has any questions for Andy Jorgensen, you can call in at 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896, or you can post in our chat room and post a question or comment. Now, I'd like to start off with discussing the secret agreements that were released last month. And I know your district, the 37th district, got all sorts of divided. And so these have been a particular interest to you and your constituents.
Right. Well, what you're referring to is during the process of the redistricting, the Democrats were pretty much blocked out of any of the talks with the attorneys that were hired, Michael Best and Friedrich. And while that was going on, because, of course, the governorship and the houses of the assembly and the Senate are all Republican. So they went and hired a law firm that was very partisan. And while that was going on, they didn't discuss anything with us as Democrats, even though they said we were a client just like they were with this law firm. But as it turns out, while that was going on, they had these secret agreements drawn up. Where, as I understand it, each legislator would come in and sign their name to a document, a legal document that you and I paid for as taxpayers, off-site, off the Capitol, and it pretty much said you were able to talk about what you were about to see. You know, and Sarah, I'm wondering if my Republican colleagues felt shame when they sat in that off-site meeting discussing redistricting plans with private attorneys. I wonder if they felt shame for you in using their power and taxpayers' money to secure their own political futures with a fixed map. The Republicans must have felt that they had something to hide, or they wouldn't have promised to keep it quiet. In signed legal documents, nearly every Republican lawmaker pledged, and I quote, not to disclose the fact and or contents of redistricting talks. And I want to believe some of them didn't read the fine print. But in the wake of this scandal, many Republicans have gone on the defensive, like small children caught with their hands in a cookie jar. Now unable to remain silent, they're trying to talk their way out of this mess. And one disturbing angle they say is that this is the way it is, and this is both sides do it. Well, I'm here to tell you, Sarah, on your show, I would never sign a legal document that asked me to keep information away from the people that I serve. Never.
Well, I'm glad that you said that, because my senator, Neil Kedzie, actually, and this was written up in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, so you guys can go back and read it. It was about 3 weeks ago it was written up. He lied to a constituent and said he didn't sign it, or his office did. I don't know if he did. His office did, and responded to a constituent who asked him. He said twice his office said he didn't sign it. Then he comes out and says he signed it. So I knew someone who asked our representative, Tyler August, if Tyler August had signed it. Tyler August's answer was, read the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about Neil Kedzie. That was Tyler August's answer to it. And it took another four emails to get Tyler August to send the agreement, but he never fully said he signed it. He just sent the agreement with his signature on it. So I would guess that would be some sort, you know, personally, they're not coming out and telling it, so I would think that there is some shame with that. Just from the responses we've gotten from ours.
It's disturbing, to say the least. In the Janesville Gazette, they asked two area legislators about this, and Representative Steve Noss, he went into spin mode, and he called the pledge similar to the legislation process. You don't go around publicly discussing bills when they are still in draft form. But Representative Noss talks about bills in draft form all the time. We all do. And if you wanted to know what I was working on, and you could open records me right now, you could ask me. I'd tell you what I'm working on, even though it's not out there in co-sponsorship form yet, or even in bill form. But it's all the people's business. That's what I don't like about this, that some are describing this as business as usual. And it's not. There is no secret agreement that I've ever signed or would ever sign when it comes to drafting legislation to hopefully make our state better or to work on things. It just, it's not something that we do. And so to hear that, oh, you all do it. No, we don't all do it. And I would never do that. That's just not something I believe in. And I don't think it's something we do in Wisconsin or in America for that matter. And then Representative Evan Wynn, who's new to the Assembly, he had the audacity to say of this pledge, it had nothing to do with secrecy. It was very much like the process we go through when we are developing legislation. Well, while Representative Wynn might get a gold star from Republican leaders for using their talking points, I don't think the average person will be impressed. Now, way back in grade school, we all learned how a bill becomes law. And confidentiality agreements are not part of the legislative process, period. And I believe we as a body need to do what we have to do to make sure that this harmful behavior doesn't happen in the future.
Now, you were talking about spending taxpayers' money on it. Why is it all right for Republicans to spend taxpayer money on stunts like this that favor them, but they are against spending taxpayer money on the recall, which is our constitutional right?
Well, that's a good question, on top of that, they keep saying that we're broke, and turns out the budget's not balanced, but yet we had all this money to go and spend wildly on partisan lawyers on a process that could have been taken care of by the lawyers that already work in the Capitol, and they are nonpartisan. So I'm in favor of a bill that's out there. I believe Representative Brett Halsey has got it in the Assembly, and it has to do with taking the politics out of the redistricting process that we have to go through every 10 years. And it's patterned after what they do in Iowa, and it's basically saying we'll just have a whole new entity, one that will be nonpartisan, and they will look at the different setups and the different population numbers and all the things we have to do when it comes to redistricting time, and do it that way, period, end of story. And I'm hoping that people know there's a bill out there like that and get a hold of their representative and say that they should sign on that bill, because it's time. It's time that we do this. It's expensive. It's wrong. It's unethical in many ways what's been happening, and it's time to change it.
Now, I have a question in the chat room from Joanne. And she asks, isn't the point of having drafts of legislation to give other people the opportunity for input?
Absolutely. Joanne, you're exactly right. Unless, of course, you're up to something that's devious or something that you're not very proud of, but you feel you have to do it for political reasons, I guess. I don't know. Because I have a long history of getting my ideas from the people I serve in the district that I'm in. I have my MAKE legislation, which I'm very proud of, which, by the way, I turned in over a year ago. It's AB 9 and 10, and it was born in a little factory in Lake Mills in my district at Astalon Engineering. I looked the owner in the eye and said, what can we do to help? And he answered me. And so the MAKE legislation means marketing, manufacturing, and keeping employees. And that legislation, all through the process, I was sharing it with other employers in my area, making sure I was getting it right, hearing from them, getting their input, people that I serve that are very smart. I mean, we have a lot of good people in Wisconsin that when they hear that you're working on something like that, they have something to add. They may be critical of it, too, whatever. But they're there to help and try to make it better and something that will work for everyone. And so to not allow people to be a part of that process is a mistake, and in many ways unethical. And when it comes to redistricting, it's supposed to have a spot where people are supposed to be able to say, hey, did you think of this? You want to look at that. This is changed, and I don't know if it showed up on what you're looking at. Whatever it might be, but it's supposed to be an open process, and it certainly wasn't with these the secrecy contracts, that's really disturbing. And I hope that we can, like I said, we got to talk about this as a body, I think, as in the Assembly, and I hope so in the Senate, that these kind of things don't happen in the future on any legislative level that we have at the Capitol. Because I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, you don't want this type of behavior to be in your Capitol. And in this case, not in the Capitol, but across the street in a back room in a law firm. This has got to stop.
So do you guys have a bill that you're going to be drafting then to try to make sure we can keep this in check so next time we don't waste taxpayers' money for things
certainly
that can be
looking
done?
Certainly looking at that, finding how we should go about it. But, yeah, absolutely. It's something that I hope we can do, and we can do it together.
Now,
in their case, they've already done this, but the word's out. The secret's out. The jig is up, as they say. And so hopefully they know that this is something they're not proud of, and hopefully that they, too, having done it already, we'll say, you know what, I made a mistake. Let's make it so that this can't happen again.
Now, when do you think the redistricting is going to be finished? When do you think this is all going to be done and over with?
Well, that's a good question. The judges, the federal judges, they had the court case last week. And prior to that, too, was just interesting. They wanted so much for the legislature to do it themselves. They said, hey, let's have you guys go back and work on this together and then come up with a plan that makes sense. And the Republicans pointed to some court case or whatever from 1952 saying that they couldn't. And they went on and on. And finally, he said, well, are you sure you don't want to go and work on this together? Because we believe that's the way it should be done. And they said, no, we aren't going to do that. So they had their court case, went for about a day or two. And now it's in their hands, and there's several things that can happen, I guess. They can change the maps. They can keep them as is. There's all kinds of different options. And let's say that they do change the maps. I'm sure the Republicans will probably appeal that. And if they do, it goes to what I find interesting, to the United States Supreme Court. And that's where the appeal will then be heard. So this could take some time. But I believe that they're going to have their decision made here real soon. They said, and this was last week, it was going to take about 2 weeks. So we're about halfway through that. So maybe in the next few days we'll be hearing a decision as to what's going to happen next.
If they don't like the maps, if the Supreme Court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, throw out the maps. The federal courts throw out the maps with the lawsuit. Where do the map? Do they revert back to the old maps? Do they actually change the maps to a certain way to fit what they're fighting against? What do we use? What maps do we use then?
It's my understanding that they have the ability to draw up their own version of the maps. So they would draw them up.
Okay, and if
that's what I understand.
Okay,
what's
so the courts, the federal courts, then would draw the maps up, and then how? What would the then the Republicans then would fight it and then we'd go to court? Or if they accepted it, would everyone have to vote on it? What's the two areas?
Well, I think, this is all very brand new to me. But it's my understanding that they have the ability to drop the new maps, and those will be the maps. And but there is an appeals process, as I mentioned, and that would go to the United States Supreme Court. And then they would make their case there and see if the United States Supreme Court would see it differently or if they would agree with the federal judges. That's where it would be next. But my concern is, you're getting at is while this is all going on, that clock keeps ticking. And there's going to be an election coming up this fall. Regardless of what's happening here. So my hope is that whatever happens, it can happen soon, and speed is an element to it, but I want to get it right. But, there is an election coming up, and we'll have to see how that fits in with what happens in the courts.
You have to excuse me. I'm having a coughing fit.
Uh-oh.
So, anyway, I have a question out of chat room if I try to catch my voice here.
Get a glass of water there, Sarah.
I'm trying. I know. I'm trying here. You were talking. You were talking long enough for me. That's all right.
Okay.
Joanne from the chat room says, I have another question. How can anyone keep up with all the proposals that keep coming from the Republicans?
Well, sometimes you wonder if that's by design, because there's just so much coming down. Last night I was at my mechanic getting my oil changed. And we were discussing what was going on. And this is a pretty good guy that keeps on top of things. And he was sharing with me what he knows. And then I would give him my perspective and then what I knew about whatever we were talking about. It was a gambit of things. But he's going, I never heard that. Oh, I didn't hear that. When did that happen? Oh, my gosh. Well, that why isn't anybody talking about that? You get that a lot. And I think Joanne has hit the nail on the head. There is just so much going on all at once that it's really hard to concentrate on all of it. I mean, you've got redistricting going on. You've got the recalls going on. You've got the different legislation that's happening in the Capitol right now. And this is a busy time just because we're ending the session here on March 15th. The Fitzgeralds have deemed that is the last day. And that's up to them, and whatever their reason is. It doesn't have to be that way. They could go on longer, but they decided that March 15th is it. And so that's just a few weeks left. So there's a lot of bills that are trying to get their day in the sun right now and move through the process. So you've got that going on. And there are different decisions being made all the time. And so I'm hoping I have through my office, I have weekly updates that I send out and hopefully in trying to combat this and trying to decipher through all this and hopefully make sense of some of this and get people up to speed as to what's going on. Of course, then the mining bill is out there too. That's if it's going to happen or not, which version is going to be out there. It's going to be the assembly version. Scott Fitzgerald decided that he didn't like that there was another bill being worked on, it turns out, or that the committee was working on some things. And so he went with the assembly version, a very extreme version when it comes to that. And so that's going to be moved forward. So you have all of this going on. And for a regular Joe, or Joanne in this case, it's hard to really get your arms wrapped around too many of these different topics. Because they are just happening all at once and so fast. So I agree. But we have to do our best, and that's what I attempt to do as a representative, is to try to help you as someone I represent to make heads and tails of it. So if you call me or if you write me or email me, I do my best to get back to you to let you know what it is I know about whatever it is on your mind and then how I feel about it and what I plan to do when it comes time to vote on it.
Of all these bills that are being pushed through, how many of them are Democratic bills?
Not very many. That's just the way it is. It's very, very partisan right now. Our state is so divided, and our capital is extremely divided when it comes to ideas and different things that are going on, like the MAKE bills. I mentioned those earlier. This is a bill that would create jobs. And in the hallways of the Capitol, my Republican colleagues tell me they love these bills. They really understand them, and they think they would be good for our state, but they'll never see the light of day. Like, for instance, I told you that these bills have never gotten a public hearing yet, Sarah. They haven't been moved one inch from where they were a year ago. And whether or not you're a Republican or Democrat, wouldn't you think it'd be a good idea to at least take a look at these bills, talk about them, make sure that we have a hearing on them so all voices can be heard on these jobs bills? But no, not in this climate, not in this administration. This is something that is going to be kept on ice. Why? My belief is that because it has come from a Democrat. I introduced it, and they don't want to give me a victory, if you will, a bill that becomes law, and have a Democrat do that. Instead, they'd rather talk about buying beer at 6 in the morning or something like that, and that's just ridiculous. And then a lot of people, they don't like to hear that. When I tell them I have a jobs bill or a couple of them in this case, where are they? Well, they're not being moved, not even being talked about, and that's a shame because at least I hope we can get to the point where we can at least talk about them. And if you don't like them, tell me what you don't like. Tell me what's wrong with them. Tell me how we can work together to fix them. Let's get on that track rather than just playing these partisan politics. But that's the way it is right now in the Capitol.
Can you by chance quantify not many? Is it 5, 10, 2?
Oh, gosh. No, it just – there are a few, and I'd hate to get it wrong, so I'm not going to even try, but it just is not anything really that shows up on the radar all that much. For a while there, it wasn't any. It was we were deep into the session, and we brought it up a few times that there hasn't been one bill moved by from a Democratic author. But I think there have been some now since then, but it's just a few that I can't remember them off the top of my head.
Okay. Well, I know that there's been a lot of raids going on. I know we had two raids in particular, the raid on the mortgage settlement and the Working Lands Initiative raid. I know you've been on top of that as well. You want to talk a little bit about the raids?
Yeah, and don't forget, the other one was the raid on the election campaign fund. I was just talking to some folks last night about that one. Remember, that's the one where you, when you did your taxes, you had that little box that said, would you like to donate a dollar for public campaign funds? So your friends and neighbors, regardless of their affiliation of a Democratic or Republican, you want a regular person to run for office is basically what this would help with. And you took that pen or pencil and you checked off that box. You said, I want my dollar to go to that initiative. I want that to happen. Well, remember, the governor and his rubber stamp Republican majorities, they took that money, and it was over $1 million. And that's pretty considerable. You think about that. When it gets only a dollar at a time from people doing their taxes, and there's over $1 million in this fund, that's crazy that that is all gone now. It was, you know, that fund wasn't the perfect. It could do more. It probably should have, but we should have tried to fix it. But instead, the Republicans, they just got rid of it, and they raided the fund in there. Now, back to Joanne's point, as you mentioned, the Working Lands Initiative, that fund has been, is the Republicans want to raid that. And to her point, yeah, there's so much going on. How do you keep track of all of it? But this is one that most people haven't heard about because it happened in the Agriculture Committee. And Republicans in the Assembly Committee on Agriculture last week approved a bill that would raid $125,000 in funding from the Working Lands Initiative for an animal registration program. Now, don't get me wrong, Sarah. I think the premise registration is important. Important for public health, but raiding another fund to pay for it is irresponsible. And there were other options. In joint finance, they have what they call referred to as a rainy day fund, discretionary spending, and it's an appropriate fund for times like this. Money's available through the joint finance committee, and we as Democrats tried to say, well, let's get the money there. Why do we want to go raiding a fund in order to move things around? Why don't, if that money is available, take it from there? And I'm especially concerned because where I come from, in Jefferson County, we've been a leader in farmland preservation. And if this raid is approved, it could put projects in jeopardy. It could put this whole program in jeopardy. I mean, you've taken $125,000 as a third of the fund. Okay, so you're taking a third of it away. And with this move, Republicans are pitting farmers against farmers. And that's not good for Wisconsin. And they're also breaking their campaign promise again by raiding segregated funds.
And how much are they taking out of these funds?
Well, in this case, it was $125,000 that they needed to put over into premise registration. So, and like I said, just to go back a moment, they didn't have to do that. There is no way to – you didn't have to do it this way. You could have taken the money that is available and meant for times like this and used that. But for whatever reason, that didn't happen. And what we're doing is we're taking a really good program. We take thousands of acres out of agriculture a year, and put it in, and you don't get that land back. And I know there's a strong initiative, especially where I come from, to if farmland, have it remain farmland, because if you build on it and you do things like that, you don't get it back again. It's not like it was before. And so we want to just try to make sure that for those initiatives and that for those counties, in this case Jefferson County, and there's a lot of others that want to have their counties, a part of it remained farmland, let's help them with that. In other states, in Pennsylvania, this is a big thing, and it's a good thing too. It makes the marriage between the communities, the municipalities, in the villages, if you will, get along with those rural parts of our state. And there should be a nice marriage there because it does help land values when there is land that's always going to be farmland. And it makes the land that has houses on it go up. Their value, and it's a really, I could talk on and on about this, but the bad thing is that this fund is slowly, I believe, you know, it's starting to die because we're going to take the money out of it.
Are there sources we can go to see or investigate on our own regarding the fund rating?
Well, you can always check in with your representative. That's what I hope people do. In this case, you can always call me if I'm your representative, and I will share with you what I know about it. And I hope that people get that that relationship with their representative. Now, some people may say, well, I don't like my representative. But you know what? They are still the people that vote for you, and they should be hearing from you. Don't use that as an excuse to not write or call your representative and let them know how you feel and find out how they feel about rating funds, in this case, the Working Lands Fund. Find out if it comes before them, are they going to vote for it? And if not, what are they going to do? Are they going to vote against it, or are they going to offer an amendment? But that's the best place to start, I believe, is with your own representative.
Okay. Joanne has a question. I stuttered on that because my representative doesn't answer. So.
Well, you know, I'd still keep trying. I would still keep trying, calling and writing, and make your voice heard.
We're trying.
Okay, all right.
Joanne asks, how will this mess be fixed once the Dems have control of the Senate again?
Well, if the Democrats get control of the Senate and their governor remains in power and the Assembly is still Republican-controlled, some of these things that we're talking about are not going to be repealed. In a lot of cases, especially like let's take, for instance, Workers' Rights Act 10, that's going to, for that to be backed up and fixed, you'll have to have both branches, and you'll have to have the governorship probably to do that. I mean, anything can happen, I guess, but to be realistic about it, you need both branches of our government, or I should say both houses, not branches, but and you need the governorship to change a lot of the stuff around.
Last question, because I know you've got to get going here, and I appreciate your time and waiting early on. You have a bill for protecting the courthouse workers. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Sure. It was a big day yesterday. We know that dedicated employees in our judicial system come into contact with disturbed, distressed, and sometimes dangerous people because of the nature of their work. And with AB 424, the state can make it clear that we value courthouse workers and offer them a better sense of security. The idea of this legislation was sparked by a disturbing incident at the Jefferson County Courthouse that involved someone who yelled at employees there saying, "If I had dynamite, I would blow you up." And trying to prosecute the case, the Jefferson County District Attorney found that current state law allows anyone who intentionally causes or threatens to cause bodily harm to a judge to be charged with a Class H felony, which holds a penalty of up to $10,000 fine and 6 years in prison. However, violence or violent threats directed at other courthouse employees cannot be prosecuted in that same way. It's just judges. Now, the DA, who is a Democrat, and her name is Susan Happ, a very good lady, and very smart, very, very hardworking, and you might want to get her on your show at some time, too, Sarah. Susan Happ is, I'm a big fan. And we worked together on this, and we're drafting AB 424, which would make an individual is guilty of a Class I felony if the intentionally cause or threaten to cause bodily harm to anyone working in a courthouse. And this felony conviction comes with a punishment of up to a $10,000 fine and 3.5 years in prison. AB 424 also makes an individual guilty of a Class I felony if they threaten to cause damage to a courthouse, if that damage could result in bodily harm to a judge or to a court employee. And I'm very pleased that my colleagues who serve on the Assembly Committee on Judiciary and Ethics understand the need for the legislation and voted to approve the bill in committee yesterday. And I'm now urging the Assembly Speaker, Jeff Fitzgerald, to schedule AB 424 to the floor. And since we only have a few days left in session, I'm hoping that we can get going on that and bring it to the floor and hopefully move this bill and have it become law.
All right. And if people want to help with that, they can just call the legislature and let them know they want that on the floor, right?
Call your representative. Okay. It's AB 424. And let them know that this is something that you're getting behind, and you want to let them know that it's out there. And to be fair, maybe they didn't know about it. Maybe they don't know that it's gotten a vote and is now in the speaker's hands, and that it's ready to come to the floor of the assembly. And you'll know something maybe they didn't know, and you'll be able to say, "I hope that you urge the speaker to bring it to the floor, and when it does, I hope you vote for it." And the same thing goes with my make bills. They're in the job committees right now, and they've been there for over a year. And if you're interested in more of those on what they entail, you can always call my office and find out. But you also should call your legislator and say, hey, did you know there's some jobs bills that make a lot of sense that came from employers in our state of Wisconsin, employers that have factories, smaller factories that make things worldwide. And they just want to be able to compete, and they want to be able to employ more people. And this is a great way to do it. The marketing and manufacturing, keeping employees bills are something that I hope that we can all get behind, Republicans and Democrats, and start creating some jobs. And to at least have their day in the sun to be able to have them debated, talked about, and just get the ball rolling in that way. That would be, in my mind, a small victory as well, just to have that happen. But it all starts with a phone call or a letter or an email to your representative and letting them know that you know that bills like this are out there and you're hoping for their support.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Representative Andy Jorgensen, for being on the Sarah Schultz Show today. And I hope we can have you on again.
Oh, I hope so, too. Thank you so much for having me, and have a great day.
Thank you. You, too. That was Representative Andy Jorgensen. He is representing the 38th Assembly District. Now we're going to jump right to Secretary of State Doug LaFollette. Thank you so much for holding, Doug. I appreciate you being on the Sarah Schultz Show today.
Good morning to you and to all your listeners.
Now, we are talking about the gubernatorial campaign, and you just said you were going to run within the last week or so. And I'm curious as to why you felt you wanted to run for governor.
Well, ever since this Walker disaster started, I've been very, very upset, obviously. I've been in public service for over 30 years, Secretary of State of Wisconsin, representing the great people of our state. And when I travel around the country, as I've done, people always say, oh, you're from Wisconsin. What a great place, a great progressive tradition. And I was always so proud to be a representative of Wisconsin. But this last year, that's all changing. And now people say to me, what's going on? What's happening? And whether it's workers' rights or education issues, health care issues, environmental issues, the wetland bill he just signed, et cetera, et cetera. Wisconsin has taken a drastic turn in the wrong direction, and that upsets me. I'm so proud of what we've been. I want to try to get us back on track. And if me running for governor in the recall is the best way to do that, I wanted to seriously consider it. Before I filed the papers with the Government Accountability Board last Thursday, the media, the newspapers, the pollsters were not including me. So I wanted to be included in the discussion so I could find out what people think, see what the polls say, see what the media says, and then see what other candidates decide to jump in. And then sometime in the next couple of weeks, we have to get this thing going with the best candidate we can find.
You know, I'm going to make a quick correction before I continue on with Doug LaFollette. Andy Jorgensen is representative of the 37th Assembly, not the 38th. That is Scott Mihalik. So I apologize for getting those mixed up. He is the Assembly representative of the 37th District. So sorry, Doug. I wanted to make that very clear before we went on. Now, what sets you apart from the other candidates? And basically, we have the two Kathleens running. What sets you apart from them?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, I've been around a while. I'm a pretty serious, mature person, and I've been here long enough to work with Republican governors and Democrat governors in the past. I know what's happening and not happening here in Wisconsin and in the state legislature and the Capitol. This is going to be a very short election, Sarah. It's only going to be a few weeks. And because I have strong name identification around the state, I've been elected a number of times. I was elected 4 times when Tommy Thompson won. I was elected last year, the only person elected when our good friend Walker got elected. So I think I have those great strengths. And I think my approach to government of independence, you know, I'm not a Madison liberal Democrat. I'm very independent, and I have support from independents, from Republicans and Democrats all across the state. That's what we need to win this election.
Now, the state is divided due in large part to the Republican-dominated media. Is it possible to bring people together in a short time, or will this divide take a long time to bridge, and how would you do that as governor?
Well, it's going to be difficult, and it's going to depend a lot on who's in the legislature. Certainly the Republicans are going to control the assembly. I think the Democrats will soon have control of the Senate. And our new governor, our next governor, starting sometime in June or so, is going to have to try to bridge that gap. And I've worked with Republicans and Democrats for years, and I think I can do that. Plus, we need someone who will listen to all the people of Wisconsin, not represent this faction or that faction, and try to bring us together to get Wisconsin going forward again. I would bring back what's called the Wisconsin idea, where you get advice from people down at the other end of State Street at the university, at the La Follette Institute, and I would talk to successful governors around the country, like the governor of Maryland, who's been doing great things and producing jobs. Here in Wisconsin, our great governor is losing jobs and making a big fuss about things, but other governors are doing the right thing and are making progress. So I think I have that kind of ability to bring people together that we're going to try to do starting in June or July.
Do you feel that you can work with the current crop of Republican legislators, including the Fitzgeralds, if you were to become governor?
It will be difficult, but it will depend on them. I think if the public expresses their outrage or their exasperation with this partisan bickering that nothing's getting done, and that they draw a line in the sand, and, you know, this is it, it's our way or the doorway, you know. If the public makes it clear, and the recall is going to help do that, when we recall Walker, that's going to send a signal to other Republicans that they ought to be more reasonable as we work together in the future.
If you become governor, what is the first thing that you would do to fix? I mean, there's so much out there that has to be changed, fixed, corrected. What's the first thing you would focus on?
Well, I think, first of all, I would call together a group of people immediately, the day after the election or the next day, and begin to start looking at the appointments that can be made. Our new governor is going to be appointing a lot of people, and I would appoint people to the DNR and to the other agencies that respected the rights of all the citizens of Wisconsin. And that would be an immediate first task. The second thing I'd do is I'd start to chop away at some of this politicalization of our government. I mean, the governor's staff is too big. I would cut the governor's staff. There's lots of political hack-type people over there that are the Walker folks. We don't need all that sort of thing. And many of the people, he politicized lots of agencies. He got the law changed so he could put his political people in lots of places. I would get rid of those political people. It would save a lot of money, and it would get government back to being the kind of civil service that we believe in that serves all the people and not one political faction, whether it's the Alex folks or the McIver folks or whoever is trying to run government now.
So you would work on getting the Alex influence out of the government then?
You bet. And that would save us money, and it would also allow us to start looking at practical solutions that would deal with all the people of Wisconsin, not just the Koch brothers and their friends in Texas.
Now, how do you feel that your governor, your campaign would do in rural versus city, urban areas? We have a deep divide, it seems to me, from urban to rural with two different needs out there. How would your campaign, and as governor, how would you deal with that?
Well, I don't think there would be a divide in the case of Doug La Follette. I mean, I've always had strong support in cities, but also in the rural areas. I've always been very attuned to the needs of small farmers, and I think they've been ignored a lot. They have serious health care problems, for example. I think we need a system that will bring the small farmer into a healthcare system, so they have good healthcare. They suffer some of the worst injuries of any occupation, and because they're small independent people, they have trouble getting health insurance that they can afford.
Now, if people want more information on your campaign, where can they go?
I have a website that last night I just worked on something new I'm going to put up today or tomorrow, but the website's very easy. It's DougLaFollette.com, and there's a couple of videos there. There's some historical information, and then there's things that I've been posting the last couple of weeks. DougLaFollette.com.
All one word?
Doug LaFollette's all one word, and then .com.
Okay, and just to make sure your name is spelled correctly, LaFollette.
That's right. I also have a website. There's a lot of stuff going on there. The website is just full of people talking about stuff.
Okay.
On Facebook.
On Facebook, and what's the Facebook info?
I don't know. You go to Facebook, and then you type in search and type in Doug LaFollette.
Okay, we'll get that up for you. Well, thank you so much for being on today. I'm sorry I had to cut you a little short, but I have to take a break here. And I wish you good luck on your campaign, and hopefully we can have you on again.
Well, the basic thing, Sarah, is we need to bring Wisconsin back together and start going forward and stop all this fighting and bickering. And I think my experience and my maturity is a good way to do that. And I thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and we'll be talking with you soon.
All righty.
That was Doug LaFollette. He is the current Secretary of State and is running for governor of Wisconsin. We are coming to our break, and up next will be Paul DeMain from News from Indian. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
Come all of you good workers, this news to you I'll tell. The rights we take for granted now, we have no right to sell. Does anyone remember the days with old John L? It's thanks to him no child of mine will know the breaker's hell. Tell me, which side are you on?
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 Which side are you on? From the world of suits and ties, they preach cooperation. Don't listen to their lies. Your parents bled and starved to claim your right to organize. Which side are you on?
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 Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz, and we will be speaking now with Paul DeMaine. He is the publisher of News from Indian Country. Do I have that right, Paul?
Yeah, you've got it right on that, News from Indian Country.
Okay, and we're going to be talking about the mining bill, or as I call it, the giveaway to the mining companies, mining bill. Now, what's the thought of the iron ore mine and the bill itself on the reservation?
Let me do a couple things, Sarah, okay. Real quick. Thank you for having me on here. I was listening to Doug a little bit there. We're hoping certainly to see him up in Sawyer County here in northern Wisconsin on March 24th when we're going to have a gubernatorial candidates forum here on the reservation. And Doug certainly is well known in Indian country, and we're hoping to get four or five candidates up there. In regards to News from Indian Country, that was the old newspaper format. Actually, we're trending in the last 2 years with our new media platform here, which is IndianCountryTV.com. And that is the URL and the name of the online television station, which has kind of got us quite a bit of publicity of late, in part because we set that camera up in Bad River at one point when they were trying to hold a feast in preparation of a hearing that was canceled because the jobs committee there run by Representative Mary Williams had initially said they were going to have one hearing in West Allis, and then our state senator Bob Jouk and our assembly representative Janet Buley scheduled a an informal hearing in Ashland, Wisconsin. So we went up there and started recording at the Bad River Reservation testimonies the night before. We went over to the Ashland High School, even though that hearing was called off, and recorded testimonies there. We went over to Hurley, Wisconsin, and recorded the entire hearing, and not only recorded it, but live broadcasted at IndianCountryTV.com. And IndianCountryTV.com, interesting enough, we've had viewers from 114 countries. And even on this mining material, which you think might not draw as much interest, we've had anywhere from 20 to 25 countries represented in the viewing streams. We did go to Madison for the hearings down there. We're going to try to get back on the wagon and see what we can follow with this process. But would you say, what's the sentiment on the reservation? I think it sums it up like this. Wow. Because this issue has been fought before when it came down to the Wolf River, the Menominee Indian Tribe, the Mole Lake Chippewa Tribe, Forest County Potawatomi, over when Exxon was trying to put a mine in that area, northeastern Wisconsin. And the issues of water quality, the issues of air quality, the issues about clean resources guaranteed either by treaty or just guaranteed to the public was a concern at that time in Wisconsin, because what Wisconsin is known as protecting its environmental resources for the public. So the sentiment kind of like is, wow, because the process has been so rapidly, and it's a process that is actually eroding those protections. We're not establishing some new threshold. We are eroding all those protections that were put in place. We know those protections in the standards forum can be met because they were met with the Kennecott mine in Ladysmith, Wisconsin. But even under those stringent requirements, there are environmental mitigating occurrences happening at that Ladysmith mine, including a plume of polluted groundwater and leakage into the nearby creek that need to be mitigated or cleaned up or dealt with. And so we already have a law in place. The sentiment amongst the leaders that I know of is, why do we need to change the law? And why is this change happening at the kind of pace that it's happening, in which the issue doesn't even become the mine itself? The issue becomes the process and how offensive this process can become when people are going to just simply jam something down the throats of Wisconsin citizens the way they see it ought to be without consulting them. So I think people are kind of appalled at the process that's going into this. There will be no mine in the Pinokies, is the bottom line. And so people that I know of are basically trying to say, well, why are we going through this to authorize something that's very, very unlikely to take place in the eye of what has to be overcome to protect treaty resources and even to protect the environment of Iron and Ashland County, which the public up there have spoken very loudly. They do not support AB 426 or the Gogebic Mining Company's mining bill that they drafted and want put into law.
Well, I wanted to thank you for backing me up and talking about the gubernatorial debate you'll be having up there and a little bit about the news from Indian Country and Indian Country TV. Yep. So thank you for doing that. We'll make sure we get those URLs out again at the end of the segment. So, but how does that, what happened in Lais's mine, what can we learn from that experience? Because as you said, that was passed under the last bill with all the stringent requirements, and we're still having tons of problems with groundwater pollution and river pollution. What can we learn from that?
Well, essentially the bill was called the Mining Moratorium Bill because what it did is it tried to bring everything to a halt where it was going and to try to slow things down, but also allow mining to occur, which we find a lot of people who simply believe that mining the earth is something that needs to be done, but it needs to be done environmentally responsible. But what I've learned, not only from that experience in Ladysmith, but what I've learned in this whole process of listening to residents of Mellon, Wisconsin, and residents of Hurley, Wisconsin, talk about what they want, is people have to understand that the old mining heritage of Wisconsin, which was mainly shaft mining, is very, very different from open pit strip mining. And so... the reason I believe that this bill was on such fast track is the more you understand Chris Klein and GTAC and the people that are behind this, including Koch Industries and ALEC, the American Legislative Education Council people, financed by Koch and Tea Party, right-wing Republican business people who want to exploit the earth, that even the people of Mellon and Hurley really thrive and cherish the environment of the area. They snowshoe, they hunt, they drink water, they pick herbs, they collect foods, they fish in that area, and they don't want to degrade it. And so there's a lot of hesitancy on their behalf to say, you know, we have a history of mining here. It was the old shaft mining. It's been 50 years since we've done any of that, but we like the idea of the jobs. But that economy has been in transition for a half a century now into a economy that's much more based on people coming up there and snowmobiling and winterizing and fishing because they were headed in that direction. And the question is why isn't there as much effort going into clean technology jobs and consulting with the Bad River Tribe, which is Ashland County's largest employer, or the Red Cliff Tribe, which is Bayfield's largest employer, or the Lacouture Tribe, which is Sawyer County's largest employer, or Lac du Flambeau, which is Vilas County's largest employer, because we're all interested in jobs. We all came from economies where we had hordes of people who were eligible to work, and so we've been working on that for a number of years, establishing clean, environmentally clean jobs, putting people to work while trying to enhance the capability and the range of the salaries and wages. Why isn't there as much effort put into consulting with people than there is to jam this thing down the throats of Wisconsin citizens. And the answer simply becomes there's been a lot of people paid off a lot of money in political donations in the last couple of years, including the Scott and Jeff Fitzgerald and Scott Walker and Cheryl LaBarre from Sawyer County and other people who belong to this ALEC organization, that this is their payback. And it's a payoff, because otherwise they would have come in they would have come into northern Wisconsin a long time ago and consulted with the people like Senator Schultz recently did, who had his eyes open to those people in Mellon who I don't think anyone spoke in favor of the bill in its present form. And I think it was important for him to see that. I think the legislators on the Assembly Jobs Committees, their eyes were open quite a bit coming to Hurley, Wisconsin, and finding that a majority of people were opposed to the bill in the present form, and they tried to tweak it with a little bit of tax thing. But you had miners coming down there from Minnesota and Michigan and saying, look, be careful, this is not a union company, it doesn't protect the workers, this is a company that does a mountaintop coal mining in West Virginia, where they just knock off the top of the mountaintop and throw it into a valley nearby and strip the coal out. That's called tremendous number of problems. This is a company that is highly efficient. It's not going to create the jobs. You know, they got machinery that you need five drivers to eat the earth up. And that the open pit, when people start thinking about a five-mile-long open pit, 1,500 feet deep and perhaps anywhere from 1,000 to half mile wide open pit, is envisioned a lot different than the shaft mining that was going on. And the question is why so fast? Why are we pandering to one mining company? And when you look around, you find that the people involved with this have paid off politicians for the last 4 or 5 years in terms of political donations, and now's their opportunity to jam this thing through. They got to do it before Walker's recalled. They got to do it before the Senate changes back over because of the recalls, and they intend to jam this down our throat probably next Monday at the Joint Finance Committee, where I suspect they're going to pass out AB 426 in its original erroneous and flawed form.
Now,
I do breathe once in a while.
Yeah, that's okay. No, I actually had a question, and it just slipped my mind, so I was hoping it would come back, and it didn't, so there we go. They were talking about, here it is, I got it now. They were talking about jobs, and that's the big thing they're saying with this bill is jobs, jobs, jobs. How many jobs would actually affect the Native community? Because they're the ones directly impacted by making a mountain into a lake, which is essentially what you're talking about doing. Plus
right.
the runoff, plus everything else that's going on.
Potential damage to the Bad River watershed flowing north into Lake Superior, which is pristine, the only thing of its kind. Here you've got international agencies awarding the Bad River tribe and designating that area as the most precious wetlands left on Lake Superior, and you're trying to say, look at, you know, this mine is going to be even safer than the Carnival cruise ship that, you know, should have not sunk, because that doesn't happen anymore. That only happened back in the days of Titanic, or this thing will be at least as safe as the nuclear reactors in Japan, because that stuff just doesn't happen anymore. Accidents don't happen. The earth doesn't do strange things. But My thing is this, is that you haven't even awoken, I think, what I call the warriors of northern Wisconsin. I haven't seen them present. I didn't see them in Madison. I haven't seen them at the blockades or anywhere else. They haven't even awoken that anger yet. And that's why I'm saying there will be no mine in the Pinokies, because northern Wisconsin and the people who would defend it have not been in Madison. That's kind of like the front lines of people trying to work with the system. And they showed up in large crowds and they made their speeches and they tried to impact the political process. But that is the people who are trying to work within the system to educate it in a way. When I knew that it was about a broken process and not a mine, when Chairman Wiggins was told he had 3 minutes to speak and that he shouldn't change the subject and ask questions like, who sponsored this bill? And he was told that, don't change the subject. You're here to testify, not to ask questions. I realized that the process under Governor Scott Walker and this little triangle of ultimate the coup d'etat that was pulled off between the Fitzgeralds and Walker meant that the process was broken, and they were not going to hear what people in northern Wisconsin say. So we've heard people say, well, it's going to be 500 jobs. Well, it's going to be 700 jobs. Well, it's going to be 1,500 jobs. Oh, it's going to be thousands of jobs. There's going to be 10,000 of auxiliary jobs. You would think at this particular point that this mine, if it goes in, is going to be the savior of even Europe, because if it goes in, it'll help stimulate jobs in Greece and Italy and everything where they're going through all these austerity measures, because create a million jobs by its impact of going in, which is the PR at a time when people are struggling and they want jobs. They're willing to work, but the question is what the quality of it is. We had miners from Minnesota come over and say, look, we built the substation, the electrical substation last year in Hurley. They're getting ready to put the mine in. They're slowly building up the infrastructure. And he says, when I came in, I brought my crew from Minnesota. We didn't hire anyone from Hurley or Ashland or Ashland County or Iron County or Wisconsin. We were a crew who knows how to build electrical substations for potential mines, and we were brought in. It didn't create a single job. And so the local impact, I doubt, is going to be minimal. Yeah, there'll be a few people who are going to get a job. They'll probably even get a good paying job, but they're not going to get the kind of things that are high technical that you're going to need. Those people are going to be shifted from other places and brought in.
Now, one last question, then we're going to have to go, but have Klein and the others approached the tribes at all, or at least the Bad River Reservation, to talk about what's going on or anything like that? Have you had any conversation with anyone other than a couple representatives?
No, my understanding is that I don't think Klein, you'll see him, but my understanding is that a couple mining representatives had called for a meeting last year sometime up in Ashland County, in which there were tribal representatives at the meeting, and they said at that time when they got their drilling core permits that they were going to work within Wisconsin laws and consult and work with the laws that they could work with the law as it was and put it in, and that's obviously changed. But I'm not aware of any consultation with any of the tribes on any formal basis. In fact, the real sad thing is that there's been no consultation at the state level as well. These committees have just pretty much jammed their intent through. They're going to do it on Monday. They're going to vote this bill out, even though they know it's a loser, because they want to be able to say, look at all these Democrats had a chance to create a job and they didn't, as a political tool, and that's what it's coming down to. If they put half the effort to come to northern Wisconsin and find out who we are, they wouldn't have to ask stupid questions like, well, we hear there's some kind of a treaty and that there's some Indians up here that are angry about something. Who are these Indians and what is this treaty thing? They need to come in northern Wisconsin a little bit more often and understand that this is the northern part of the state. It is part of Wisconsin, but you don't legislate northern Wisconsin bills and things for the people of northern Wisconsin by sitting in Milwaukee and thinking you're doing a good thing.
Or putting on people on the committee there from the southwest or southeast section of Wisconsin. My senator was, I'm right by Illinois, and my senator was the guy running it. So
the closest assembly person was Mary Bang Bang Williams out of Medford, Wisconsin, and some people said when she called that hearing in West Allis, you know, she's a dairy farmer. The next thing we're going to hear is that they're having a hearing on dairy farming in Las Vegas because people drink milk. You know, well, that's why you take it to West Allis. There's people that want the jobs there. But go to where it's going to impact it. You know, they have not had a formal hearing in Ashland. That is the county that's going to be impacted by the watershed runoff and everything else. They should be there talking to those people. And Bad River should be at the table in consultation format, not at the desk asking for a little bit more than 3 minutes to say what they want to say.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for being on today. I appreciate you doing that. I hope we can have you on again to talk more about this. And as things progress, maybe we can have you on just to come and talk about what's going on up off of the reservation so people know you know, the reservations and the Native people are part of the state, too, and I like people to know more of what's going on up there. So
sounds good. I'd appreciate that. And tell Doug to come up north here on the 24th for our candidates forum. Love to have him up here.
I will pass it on, I promise. And what's those, how can people follow the website or follow Indian News TV?
The main one is the video presentations, especially on the mining thing. Great testimony at IndianCountryTV.com. That's www.IndianCountryTV.com. Look for the digital library. The files are there. Our website is IndianCountryNews.com. Join with us. Take a peek at what we're reporting on about Indigenous affairs around Wisconsin and pretty much the Western Hemisphere.
Great. Well, thank you so much again for your time. Good luck with everything, and we will definitely be talking with you soon.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Have a good day.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Paul DeMaine from Indian News from Indian Country. And again, those websites are www.IndianCountryTV.com and www.IndianCountryNews.com. Now, we're going to go straight to Nicole here. This is Nicole Safar from Planned Parenthood. Thank you so much for being on the Sarah Schultz Show today, Nicole.
Thanks, Sarah, for having me.
And thanks for holding on. I appreciate that. We've been running behind from the very beginning, so that's
Oh, no, that was great to hear a little bit more about the mine stuff. So,
well, and it's nice to hear from the people that are directly affected instead of people who, you know.
Yeah, you'd think that would be important.
Slightly. Now, I want to get right into, we don't have a lot of time, and I want to get right into this. The war on women is nationwide, but Wisconsin has passed their own laws on women's health. The bill SB92/AB154, same bill, different numbers in each area, passed in the Senate on February 23rd, is now waiting in the Assembly. Planned Parenthood was one of the groups that was opposing this bill. Now, Nicole, can you talk a little bit what's in the bill and why you guys are opposed to it?
Sure. This bill is, actually, I think, one of the worst bills we've seen this session. It prevents insurance companies from offering coverage for abortion services. So essentially, what the bill says is that it's telling private insurance companies what kind of coverage they can sell to citizens who are buying it with their private dollars. And all of this is set within the context of the healthcare exchanges that we are going to be setting up under the Affordable Care Act. And I think it's very interesting that the Republican leadership has made this bill a priority to pass this session, but everything else that has to do with the Affordable Care Act, we are just pretending doesn't even exist. We're giving back money that is supposed to help us implement it. Governor Walker issued an executive order saying that he would set up the exchanges, then he issued an executive order saying he wouldn't. Like, they have dug their heels in so much on implementing health care reform. But this one thing, yes, let's restrict access to abortion in case we ever get to the place where we might have health care reform in Wisconsin.
So the group that talks about not wanting big government and not wanting to intrude in our lives is now actually telling private insurances what they can and cannot cover?
Exactly, yes. During committee debate on this, that point kept getting brought up again and again, but it just fell on deaf ears.
So what's the alternative then for women who are in, for whatever reason, need to have an abortion?
Well, right now, about 80% of private insurance coverage covers abortion care. A lot of people don't know that. It's not something that a lot of people think about or plan for. By its very nature, abortion happens either when you have an unintended pregnancy or when something goes very wrong with a pregnancy. The current landscape is that most women have this coverage. If health insurance companies are prevented from offering these services, I really think that the impact is going to be felt the most by women who have complicated pregnancies, who have problems during their pregnancy, and who are ending up having to terminate a wanted pregnancy because of a medical reason, either with the woman or with the baby. So a lot of times in these situations, the procedures are much more complicated, and there are some other health risks, like a woman may have to have a blood transfusion or something. We have an activist who, while she was pregnant, had a blood clot in her lungs, and continuing the pregnancy would have killed her. So she had to, you know, make that very tough decision and then go through trying to save her life and prevent that blood clot from killing her as well. So it was very expensive, is my bottom line, I guess. This bill is going to impact women who have very expensive medical bills that they're going to have to pay, and then not only are they going to lose a pregnancy, but they're going to be saddled with debt that their insurance will not be allowed to cover under Wisconsin law.
Now, who are the legislators that have turned a deaf ear to Planned Parenthood and to what's doing? And how many of them, and what about the female legislators? Are you getting any support from them, or is this completely partisan?
This is completely partisan. Unfortunately, this particular bill is sponsored by some healthcare providers that we have in the state legislature. There is a Senator Pam Galloway, who's a senator up in Wausau, is a woman's health provider. She has provided breast cancer care for women, and she is one of the leading proponents of restricting access for women's health care in the state legislature. It's really unbelievable.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me, but in a way. In a way, it's sad. It's just very sad.
It is.
It's very sad that women who need the help the most are the ones that are getting cut.
Right. And, you know, when I testified in front of one of the committees on this bill, it was a committee almost solely of men. The representative, Therese Brazeau from Madison here, was the only woman on the committee. And I was like, you know, you don't know who in your life this bill is going to impact, but it's going to impact someone in your life, and I really hope it's not your wife or your daughter or your sister, because this is going to create awful situations for women and their families.
Now, what about, I know the Blunt Act was not in Wisconsin. Are we looking at something that could occur, something like that could occur in Wisconsin? And, I mean, how are you guys fighting that kind of stuff?
Sure. Well, so the Blunt Act was in Congress, and we were able to hold it back, keep it from passing. But essentially it would have allowed employers to decide they did not want to cover birth control under their health insurance, employee health insurance plans, for whatever reason. They could just say, I don't like birth control. I think that, you know, people have seen in the media the last few weeks, especially, a lot of debate about access to birth control, and you hear the Republican presidential candidates talking about it. You hear people in our state legislature talking about it, you know, as if access to contraception is something we should even be debating in 2012. It kind of boggles my mind that this is in the political discourse. This has no place in the political discourse. This is, you know, women's health care that 98% of us use at some point in our lives. And when you've got, you know, people out there, powerful people in elected office or people who, you know, are donating to the campaigns of those in elected office, making comments about women who use birth control and you know, insinuating that they are promiscuous and prostitutes, I think that's a huge problem. We actually have – that actually touches really close to home here in Wisconsin, because one of Governor Walker's big donors, his name I think is Foster Freeze, he's donated over $100,000 to Governor Walker's recall campaign. Foster Freeze is also a big donor to Rick Santorum's campaign, and he made the comment last week that back in his day, all a woman needed for birth control was to hold an aspirin between her legs. So it's just these incredibly insulting and backwards comments that are happening in our political debate. And, you know, women and men, I think, people are sick of it. The average person is sick of women's health being used as a political football for the, you know, right-wing debates.
Well, maybe that's the excuse he was given. Oh, I can't do anything. He was just turned down. I don't know.
They were just trying to be polite.
I turned him down, you know, and that was just, maybe that was his reason. What really bothers me, there's so many things, but with women's health and with birth control in particular, with all of it in particular, but birth control, having a woman be able to decide when they have children, when they don't, is a huge boon to not only the woman, the family, but the community, the
Absolutely.
Country, the economic portion of that, because when women don't have control of their own reproduction, they have, obviously, it's the husband that has that decision, and they usually end up having more children than they can afford. A woman will usually cut back and say, we only can afford so many, and that's all she'll have is she has birth control available to her. And so it you find happier families, happier communities, better off communities economically in countries, and they're finding this in developing countries. So, you know, that's something that I don't see a lot of people talk about. And also, there's a plethora of medical problems where birth control is prescribed as a drug to help control these problems.
Absolutely. Over 50% of women who use birth control pills use them for a non-contraceptive reason. So they are essential to, you know, basic women's health care. And I think you just hit it right on by saying, you know, for most women, there are about 35 years of our lives where we can get pregnant. And most of us want two kids. So, you know, that's 33 years where we need to try not to get pregnant. And it's just a very... It's not only, you know, economic to keep families economically healthy, but women who go through multiple births are not physically healthy either. It's not, and their children aren't healthy. If you're having a baby every 18 months, that is not optimal for growing healthy children.
Or every 10 months, that can occur.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, what is it that Planned Parenthood is doing to help fight some of these bills that are coming up, or the chance that, you know, I don't take anything off the table of these Republicans. I'm assuming we're going to see something like the Blunt bill try to pass in Wisconsin since they couldn't get it through in Congress. What are you guys doing to fight all this?
Well, a big thing that we're doing is, you know, talking to people about this and really educating the public about what is happening in the Capitol, both in Madison and in Washington, D.C. So it is a great opportunity, I think, for us to do outreach and talk about how out of touch these politicians are with, you know, with our values here in Wisconsin and across the country. And we are watching how people are voting on these issues, and we are sharing that information with our supporters. We're sharing that information with voters, and, you know, we're going to have a great opportunity here a couple of times in Wisconsin over the next 8 months to really hold our elected officials accountable. I mean, I think it's one thing to talk about the issues and call the offices and say you shouldn't support this, but it's quite another, you know, when election time rolls around to say, look, you spent the most of your time this past session attacking women's health, and I'm not going to stand for that anymore. So we're going to be doing a lot of work, you know, as we get closer to the elections, making sure that our supporters and that the voters know where people stand on these important issues.
Yeah, it's interesting. We had a whole job session, and they're in another session, and not one job was created, but my goodness, women's health was attacked. Women were attacked in general.
Yeah,
so
during the special session on jobs, there were 8 bills introduced or advanced that were solely aimed at attacking women's health. 8 during that period. So it really shows, I think, what the priorities of the majority party are here in Wisconsin, and I think that the voters are sick and tired of it.
Does Planned Parenthood have a list of legislative supporters and non-supporters?
Yes, we keep track of the votes that are taken on Women's Health, and you can find that on our website. It's www.ppawi.org. And at the end of the session, which is ending next week, we'll put out a scorecard so you can see how your legislator voted on these important issues.
Okay, and that website again is www.ppawi.org.
Yes.
Now, can women's health be dovetailed into an overall comprehensive health plan for all?
I think for women, women's health is comprehensive. That for the majority of us, if we're lucky and we're healthy, managing our fertility and our reproductive system is the bulk of the health care that we need. So, yes, I think that it is an important part of the overall health care access.
Well, and if they don't work right, if your reproductive system doesn't work right, it affects the entire system. It affects the entire body.
Right. It's critical to our basic health every single day.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say that I'm so glad that there are, you know, with the jobs in particular, and I wasn't going to say this, but I think I want to, you know, apparently there's some jobs on the other side of my uterus, but we can't get there until we go through that. So, you know.
It's funny where they're looking for jobs, isn't it?
Would I be considered a job creator then? I don't know.
It's possible. You know, an interesting thing that I've been saying a lot when I've been talking to legislators is that Planned Parenthood, we actually employ about 250 people in the state of Wisconsin. So, you know, maybe they should think a little more before they start attacking and trying to restrict access to us, because we're a pretty good job creator.
That's very true. But there are so many jobs of left the state. It's sad. But, Nicole, I wanted to thank you so much for being on. And
anytime.
I would love to have you on again, and we'll continue talking about it. This is really important. We need
thank
to
so
make
much.
Sure that we get this out, because it does. It affects so many people in ways that they don't even understand or know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So thank you so much, Nicole.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Nicole Safar from Planned Parenthood. And again, that website is www.ppawi.org. Now, I'm going to go right to Representative Chris Taylor. Hello, Representative.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being on the show today. And I know you had to rush back, so thank you so much for doing that.
Sure.
And I have not written it down, and I am very sorry. I did not write down your assembly district.
Oh, sure. It's the 48th Assembly District, and it is parts of the east side of Madison, Monona, McFarland, and the town of Dunn.
Okay. I knew it was 40-something, but I was like,
48.
48. Thank you so much for being on. Now, you were just listening to the end of the Planned Parenthood with Nicole Safar talking about
Right, my good friend. Yeah, she's great.
She was. She was wonderful. Now, we're going to move on. We'll try to get back to women's health, but we have such little time. I want to talk a little bit more of the overall war on women. And last week, the Assembly passed a bill that would not pay any damages for women who are discriminated against in the workplace. Can you talk about what that bill has in it? And before you do that, I just want to let everyone know that it has passed. But it was passed by the Senate in November, so this bill is actually on the desk of the governor to be signed.
That's right. So. That's right. Well, I can't tell you, Sarah, what it was like to be on the assembly floor in 2012 debating whether Wisconsin women should be paid equally to their male counterparts. It was just unbelievable that we're still having this debate about whether women should be paid fairly. So, you know, it was a pretty vigorous debate. I have to say there was a lot of silence on the other side of the aisle from the Republicans. They didn't really jump up too much to defend this horrible bill. But, you know, it is on its way to be signed. And what this bill does is really remove the teeth from the Fair Employment Act, the teeth, the damages that can be sanctioned and leveled against employers who discriminate. So this bill, the Equal Pay Enforcement Act, that put in more substantial damages when employers discriminate against women, but other protected classes, people of color, people who have disabilities, was very, very important because part of what the state wants to do in the state's interest is to deter discriminatory behavior. And given that women are still only paid 78 cents on the dollar that their male counterparts are paid, there's a real need to get tougher in making sure women are getting a fair wage. And that was the point of the Equal Pay Enforcement Act, to really put some teeth into the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act so that when employers are found to have discriminated, there's a real deterrent because they know they're going to get penalized in a significant way. So that was the whole intent around this Pay Equity Enforcement Act last session. And, you know, it came at a time when this issue of equal pay was really being discussed because of the Libby Ledbetter issue. This was a big case that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court where a female employee had shown a pattern of wage discrimination, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, oh, you didn't comply with the statute of limitations. You should have filed this case when you got your first paycheck, and that paycheck was different than what your male counterparts received. The problem was that Ledbetter didn't know that she was not being paid fairly until after the statute of limitations had run. So this issue of pay equity had really been in the forefront, and in the legislators who brought this forward, Dave Hansen from Green Bay, who's a great champion of women, and Chris Sinicki from Milwaukee, had been working on this issue for about a decade, and finally the time was right because this issue of pay equity had really risen to the discussion on the national and the state level. And when they looked at it, you know, at the time that it was passed, the Pay Equity Enforcement Act last session, women were only getting 77 cents per dollar that men were making, their male counterparts. And these are men performing the same or substantially similar jobs. So there's no argument to be made here that, oh, well, the women were less qualified or they were paid less because they took time out of the workforce. These were people who were similarly qualified doing the same job, and still women were only getting 77 cents. Since the passage of the Equal Pay Enforcement Act, which has now, as we're talking about, been gutted by this legislature, we actually went up a penny. We actually did improve a little bit, and it might not sound like a lot, but the incremental changes have been so slow with pay equity. So since 2009, when this Enforcement Act was passed, women actually did move up a little bit. And, you know, the speculation on that, and what I believe is employers in Wisconsin saw, ooh, I better get serious about the issue of addressing wage inequity because now I could be penalized. So we did make some progress. Now, of course, that's being rolled back with a repeal of this important bill, this important statute. So, unfortunately, that's where we are right now.
Well, how does the Lilly Ledbetter bill deal with what they just repealed? Because that allows, like you said, that allows someone to take it to court up to 6 months or to get rid of the statute of limitation. How does that play into it? Is there any play at all? Is it just something
sure.
that's there?
Yeah, no, that's a bit different. You know, that deals with federal law. That was a federal case that deals with the Civil Rights Act, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And so now under federal law, when you bring an employment discrimination claim or a wage claim, the statute of limitations has been changed so that it's a little more lenient for people like Libby Ledbetter. That does not impact us here in state court and with state laws. So currently, you can bring an action under federal law under, as I said, the title. I'm pretty certain it's Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. But that's different. You have to then go to federal court. There are different federal laws. There are different procedures. The Wisconsin Fair Employment Act has to do with state law that you can bring and challenge in state court. And as someone, I'm a former practicing attorney, you know, it makes a big difference where you file a case. I mean, when I was practicing, I rarely went to federal court. Most of my cases were in state court, and there's different processes and procedures. So the Equal Pay Enforcement Act just allowed women and other people to bring their case in state court and still be eligible for getting these damages that are a deterrent on employers.
You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz, and we're talking with Representative Chris Taylor from the 48th Assembly District, and we're discussing women's rights. Now, are you seeing evidence of conservative and Republican women crossing over and supporting the liberal women's rights issues?
Not really. You have not really seen that. In fact, you know, the disappointing thing for me, among all the other disappointments, I think, from this legislative session, is that the gutting of the Equal Pay Enforcement Act was actually brought in the assembly by a woman, which, you know, it's very, very disheartening. And ironically, the woman who brought it, Representative Michelle Litchens, had announced just prior to this bill coming to the assembly floor that she was not running again for reelection because of her home responsibilities and her child care responsibilities. So it's just, you know, it really struck me as such a sad note, because here's a woman who knows how hard it is to get to a place where you're elected. You know, it's not easy, especially if you have kids, and it's very, very difficult. And yet she's bringing a bill that makes it harder for women in the workforce to be paid equally. So, you know, there's definitely an irony there that on one hand, she kind of recognizes that's hard to balance. It's still hard for women to balance their responsibilities and, you know, their dedication to their children, to their home, and a successful professional life. And yet, same token, making it much harder for women to get paid what they're entitled to be paid. But that, it's a big disappointment, honestly, to not see. I'm not surprised, but it's still a disappointment not to see any kind of crossover on some of these issues. And, you know, honestly, on so many of the other issues, too, that have gotten a lot of national attention and a lot of state attention, this whole attack on contraception. You know, I was just listening last night to the Rush Limbaugh comments about women who use contraception, you know, calling them sluts, calling them prostitutes, and you hear nothing from Republican women in the public sphere, at the elected official level. I think Republican women are speaking out, who are constituents and voters, and I don't think they like what they're hearing, because most women use birth control at some point in their lives. But there's a real silence from Republican women who are elected officials. I really haven't heard anything. And, you know, I think it's time now that women have to be honest with ourselves. Republican women have to be honest about what their party is doing to women, and what, when you hear somebody say, well, women shouldn't have the right to get access to contraception, or women who use contraception are sluts. I mean, that's really what women are being called. I do think there's an obligation for these Republican women who are elected to speak out against this, because a lot of advancements that women have made have been dependent on having access to safe, affordable birth control. If you look at in the early 60s, when birth control pills were approved by the FDA and started to be made available, that it really coincides with women getting into the workforce, with women going to grad school, with women, you know, pursuing different educational opportunities and employment opportunities that they really hadn't had before. And part of that was finally having a affordable, effective method of planning and spacing children. Without access to birth control, the average woman would have between 12 and 15 children. Obviously, that impacts her ability to be in public life, to be in civic life, to be in employment. So birth control was such a huge advance for women. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have named family planning as one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century, because it had such incredible impact for women, both in the health, for their health, that women, you know, could plan and space pregnancies, and planned pregnancies are healthier pregnancies, but also because it had such consequences for women getting into public life, being able to pursue a graduate degree or a college degree, being able to get in the workforce. So when you hear someone attacking birth control, you know, you do have to ask yourself, what's really going on here? What is really being attacked? Because if you take away birth control for women, you take away options for women. You take away choices for women. You take away control that women have over their lives. And you do have to question, given the national dialogue that we're hearing right now from Republicans, is that what they want? Is that the goal? They want women to not have choices. They want women not to be in the workforce. They want women not to be in graduate school. But there's few options that they give women. You know, if you're going to say that birth control shouldn't be accessible and abortion should be made illegal, well, what are you saying to women? You're saying every time you have sex, you should have a child. And that, you know, is not the desire of most women and most families. That's not the desire. That's not the desire of most of these Republican legislators either. So there's such a degree of hypocrisy going on. But you also really have to question, what is the real agenda here?
Well, it obviously is a control issue, because usually in a household, you know, the typical household, the men will control the sex a lot of it, not always, and it can differ, but that's a controlling mechanism. The whole thing is control. It's about women are taking back their own power. Women are taking back their own bodies. Women are able to do more. And if you take those things away, then there's very little control.
Yep, there's very little choice. Very little choice for women. And you know what? The thing that is so scary as well, and I'm just writing about this right now, this whole issue of this war on women, is the same language that we're hearing now, that women are immoral who use contraception, that women are wrong. This is what Rick Santorum has said. Women are just wrong to use contraception. Those same words have been used throughout history to suppress women. I mean, if you just look even back to the 60s, the opposition to birth control pills, you know, women are going to be, they're going to be used immoral, you know, they're immoral. They're going to just be having sex with everybody. And then if you look to later in the 60s, when finally the U.S. Supreme Court said that married couples had a right to get contraception. This was a very, very important case called Griswold v. Connecticut. It was the first instance of the U.S. Supreme Court recognizing this right of privacy that is so, so important to women and families. And same words. Oh, my gosh, you're going to legalize birth control. You know, you're going to have women are going to, they're immoral, everyone's going to be having sex. And then if you go to the 70s and look at the rhetoric against the bill to repeal the Wisconsin criminal ban on contraceptives for unmarried people, you hear the same language, and it's the same language we're now hearing against women, to stigmatize them, to call them names, to say they're immoral agents who use birth control. And, you know, we have got to stop it, or we're going to keep fighting the same fights our grandmothers fought, the same fights our mothers fought. And this same language is going to be used against our kids, our grandchildren. If women, and men too, men are a very, very important piece of this movement to say that women deserve to be treated as full citizens. Women deserve to have their rights respected. But if we don't stand up strongly against this now, this cycle is just going to keep continuing to future generations. And, you know, we have to fight harder than ever to make sure that we are being treated as full citizens, that we are, our rights are being respected. But, boy, I sure never anticipated that some of these debates we'd still be having in 2012.
It does. It floors me that we have to keep fighting the same fight we fought 100 years ago and you know, I keep telling people I'm afraid they're going to take away my right to vote next, because that's what we're getting down to.
Right.
And, you know, the other thing is these people that say these comments about the women and contraception, and I'm sure they have daughters. I'm sure they have nieces. I'm sure they have wives. I'm sure they have mothers. And I'm sure more times than not, they have used them. I'm pretty sure Rush's wife is because he's married for the fifth time, I'm pretty sure she's using something, okay?
Yeah, right.
How is it that they can say this and then go home and it doesn't apply to their family? Because, it's very interesting, the double standard that we're seeing here. It's you can't use it if you're not with me, but if you're in my family, then, you know, I don't see it that way.
Right.
This double standard, this has to end.
Well, and you see that so often. I mean, in so many different issues that impact women, it's the same double standard you see in the abortion debate as well.
Chris,
I mean, when
I'm sorry, I have to cut you off. I'm so sorry. We have about 30 seconds left before the show is over. So I wanted to thank you. I'd love to have you back on. Well, I'd love to talk about it more, and thank you for being a champion for women's rights.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you so much for everything you do, Sarah. Thanks to all your listeners as well.
Right, and we'll talk to you soon. Have a great day.
You too. Take care now.
Bye. Well, we are at the end of the show. I don't have a lot of time, so it'll be a very quick wrap-up. So thank you so much for listening to the Sarah Schultz Show today. I'd like to thank my producer, Bill, for helping out on the show. You can download the show from iTunes or listen to the archive shows at blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz. Don't forget to listen to it on Saturday at WIDELP, Tuesday at WHYS, and on Sunday at WFAQ. Remember, Wisconsin, forward, together, forward. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.